My guest at this time is David Gardenstein-Ross. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Terrorist Radicalization at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He's also out with a brand new book entitled Bin Laden's Legacy, Why We're Still Losing the War on Terror. It's just been released early this month. And David, thanks so much for being with us.
Greg, it's always a pleasure to join you.
There is a misconception out there, certainly according to your book, but I think certainly even among terrorism experts, about where we currently stand right now compared to where a lot of political figures think we stand right now. You have folks in both parties saying, well, Bin Laden is dead. We have essentially pushed the Taliban to a large extent into Pakistan and certainly away from a position to control Afghanistan. So therefore, the mission has been a success. Where are they wrong?
I think that if one understands security, not so much as the fact that we have more policing measures in place, but rather looks at security as the difference between our own capabilities and our resilience in the face of a terrorist attack versus al-Qaeda's capabilities, it's entirely clear to me that the gap between the United States and al-Qaeda has narrowed over the course of the past decade. That's not to say that al-Qaeda is anywhere near the United States level of power. Obviously, they aren't. But there's very little, to me, external indication that al-Qaeda has been significantly weakened. While the United States has, and not all of that is due to our fight against al-Qaeda. Quite obviously, al-Qaeda was not responsible for, say, the subprime mortgage crisis that the country experienced. But regardless of the various causes of our weakened condition, you know, the economy, for one, the national debt, our war weariness, it's a fact that we are where we are right now. The final thing I want to say about that is a lot of the notion that al-Qaeda is on its deathbed comes from pronouncements of officials talking, for example, about how if we eliminate 10 or 20 more key leaders, we could eliminate the organization as a strategic threat. One of the problems I have with this is that we heard this kind of very optimistic talk under the Bush administration. President Bush in 2003 bragged about how three-quarters of al-Qaeda's leaders had been killed, how they had been deprived of Afghanistan as a sanctuary. In 2006, the consensus of the intelligence community reflecting the national intelligence estimate was that al-Qaeda had been defeated. And the following year, after the role in the London bombings in 2005 became clear, and after another major plot that they were involved in had been unearthed, the intelligence community had to actually shift that assessment. So I think it's very premature for the extreme optimism we're seeing. I find myself an outlier and kind of a dissenting voice on this matter. But that's not necessarily a distressing position to be in, given how wrong consensus opinions have ended up being over the course of the past decade.
Let me follow up with one question on the financial aspect of things. It's clearly a major factor here, and it's evidenced by a picture of a $100 bill on fire on the cover of your book. Bin Laden made no secret, and others in the terrorist world have made no secret, that bleeding the U.S. dry financially is one of their goals. And as you mentioned, a whole lot of other factors have come into play that have hampered our economy, probably more than funding the war on terror, both domestically and internationally. But how much does that hurt us as we try to continue to prosecute them overseas and protect ourselves at home?
It hurts us quite a bit to have diminished resources in multiple ways. One way that I think is very obvious is, you know, our resilience in the face of an attack. The 9/11 attack was one that we as a country were able to absorb. I mean, it wasn't the easiest thing. It was an attack that cost us somewhere between $1 and $2 trillion. But we absorbed that attack, and we kept on going. Our economy is smaller today. There are various reasons that the 9/11 attack would be more costly today than it was a decade ago, including the fact that resources are scarcer, which would drive up the cost of rebuilding and other sort of costs of material damage. But for one thing, our resilience is worse. For a second thing, one thing that made us safer a decade ago was the fact that we had the option to ramp up the resources that we devoted to policing against terrorism. And indeed, those resources are ramped up. It's more difficult if we need to ramp up in any given situation to do so, which is not to say that we're unable. It's just becoming more difficult over time. And given that this isn't a war that ends this year or next year or 2 or 3 years from now, it's something that we have to pay attention to the greater difficulty that we have pursuing it and making ourselves safer over time. Our ability to conduct overseas interventions is increasingly being constrained as well. All of these issues make it a more difficult problem set for us to deal with.
Let me follow up on two of the critical points you made there in our remaining few minutes here, David. First of all, when it comes to our homeland response, there's obviously been anywhere from mockery to frustration with some of those measures, ranging from the color-coded system that has now been scrapped to what a lot of people consider an invasion of their privacy and other dignity at the airport with the random screening of some folks while other perhaps more suspicious-looking folks go by. You mentioned in the book that we kind of rushed into some of these policies, that they're more bureaucratic than effective. What would have been a smarter approach in those early weeks and months after the attacks?
I think the smartest thing to do would have been to implement a more efficient system of policing. You know, airport security, which you talked about, in many ways represented the most inefficient system possible. It was a system in which there was entirely random screening of people. You know, people would be pulled out for extra security quite literally at random. Thus, you had a Al Gore on one trip to Wisconsin being pulled out for extra screening twice during the course of the same trip. Now, regardless of what your listeners think of Al Gore's politics, I'm not too concerned about him trying to blow up a plane. Now, that's only a couple of incidents, but when aggregated over the entire system, something like this ends up taking a toll in that it shows that more resources are being devoted to people who don't pose a threat. Now, when I talk about terrorist profiling, when it's talked about it in general, there's this, it's often a terrible debate in that critics of the policies will talk about profiling as though it means look for the Arabs or look for other quote-unquote threatening races. That's actually a very ineffective way to go about it. One of the most promising measures is, in fact, looking for suspicious behavior, not for people who are suspicious by virtue of their skin color. I think, in my view, race can be used when you have specific indicators that a plot is being carried out by people of a certain race. For example, in October 2010, you had plots afoot that were being primarily led by Caucasian German nationals and German nationals of Turkish origin. In such an instance, looking for people who fit that particular profile makes sense, but that doesn't mean that you should search nobody else. So essentially what we have is a system in place that had been in place over the course of the past decade in which risk is distributed in an inefficient manner, where more resources are devoted to people who don't pay a threat, pose a threat, people who, 5-year-olds, 80-year-olds, the kind of demographics that haven't carried out any sort of major terrorist attack.
Last question for David Gardenstein-Ross. The book is Bin Laden's Legacy While We're Still Losing the War on Terror. And David, in terms of prosecuting the war overseas, you mentioned that taking out Bin Laden, taking out some of these other high-profile targets, these number twos and threes, one key figure supposedly involved intimately with the embassy bombings in East Africa in the last 13 years ago. If that's not necessarily having the impact that a lot of our experts would like us to believe, what would be the most effective way to really make al-Qaeda impotent?
Look, I think that taking out Bin Laden and Fazul, the individual that you mentioned related to the East Africa embassy bombing, that's a great thing. I'm not disparaging it. I'm not saying that that shouldn't be done. The Bin Laden raid really was it really was a gutsy call. Though some have derided that phraseology, that's exactly what it was. But often, we're carrying out military campaigns without having a strategy to attain an end state. I am concerned that we may be doing that in Somalia, although lately I've seen a bit more indication that we may have more of an overarching framework to try to deal with the problem of Shabaab's rise in Somalia. That's the al-Qaeda affiliate that controls a large amount of territory in the south of that country. But undertaking actions with a strategy in mind, particularly military actions, and not just using tactics in place of strategy, i.e. drone strikes, that's something which is very important in an age of constrained resources.
David, it's going to be fascinating. We've really just scratched the surface here, and we hope folks will pick up the book in an effort to dig deeper into the challenges that still remain, many of them very significant, as we mark the 10 years since 9/11. It's always great to have you with us, sir. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Greg.
David Gardenstein-Ross is the director of the Center for the Study of Terrorist Radicalization at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. His new book, Bin Laden's Legacy, While We're Still Losing the War on Terror. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.